Okay. Well, good morning. You've tuned in to the North Idaho News of the Week here on 88.5 KRFY. It's Friday, May 22nd. It's election week in North Idaho. We just had our primary elections on Tuesday, May 19th, and now we're going to talk about it a little bit, as well as other news items in other things in the news this week. I'm Jack Peterson. I'm here with Chris Bessler. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Jack. How are you doing today?
I'm doing just fine. And also joining us here in the studio is Jack Freeman from the Bonner County Daily Bee, covering the city and education, and in this case, covering the legislative races. Good morning, yes. Jack.
Good morning.
And then we're going to find out right now if this works. On the telephone, we may be talking to Zach Hagedone. Zach, are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, yes. I'll turn up your volume a little bit. Good morning, Zach. And well, how
good
are
morning,
you?
Everybody. I am well.
Okay. Well, where do we find you? Why don't you tell folks why you're on the phone and not here in the studio this morning?
Well, I'm coming to you live from my backyard writing shed as I recuperate from a surgery on my right foot, which I received on Monday.
Ouch. Well, yes, best wishes for a speedy recovery, and we'll send, listeners can send their flowers to Zach's home, where he'll be reporting from.
Well, yeah, what kind of flowers do you like,
yeah.
Zach?
gin blossoms.
Oh. Well, this is not a whiskey blossom, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. well, it's yes. We're talking politics here today a little bit in the aftermath of the election, but there is other news as well. I want to make sure we touch on this the $40 million funding granted from the Department of Environmental Quality to the city of Sandpoint for their wastewater treatment plant, $38 million loan and a $2.5 million grant for wastewater treatment facilities. But the election results are, of course, the top story this week. Let's see, at the statewide level, Governor Little once again is the Republican nominee, and he is the incumbent, and he is he defeated his seven challengers for the Republican nomination by a margin of, I believe it was, I don't have it right in front of me right now, but I think it was 58%. Does somebody have that up? No, that's okay. It was 58%. A majority of the votes went to Governor Little, but not considering that he's a longtime incumbent, not an overwhelming majority for the party's nomination. Also winning their respective nominations, U.S. Senator Jim Risch and U.S. Representative Ross Fulcher both won their primary campaigns, and then we're turning our attention to the local election results. Hold on. Yes, a state level shakeup, writes Jack Freeman in the Bonner County Daily Bee. Two of the three Republican incumbents in District 1 lost in Tuesday's May 19th primary election. Scott Herndon and Jane Souter upset the incumbents Jim Woodward and Mark Souter. No relation being a phrase that's seen a lot of publication in local papers these past few months. Cornell Reeser hung on to his District 1B seat nomination. The results for Herndon and the Herndon-Woodward race, which was hotly contested and very expensive, the most expensive one of the most expensive primary battles in the state this time around. Herndon received 53% of the vote to Woodward's 47% of the vote. Although that might just be the county results. Let me make sure I have the correct. Let's see. The the full accurate results, because this was a legislative district race, not just a countywide race. Let's see.
I have 53.5% for Herndon and 46.4% for Woodward.
Okay, that's thank you. Thank you.
Including Boundary County.
Yeah, thanks, Zach.
Yeah, that's all of District 1.
That's include, right. Okay, that's... Okay. Well, that's important. Yeah, there you go. 8,155 votes for Scott Herndon. I've got it here in front of me now, to 7,075 votes for Jim Woodward. And then in the, as I guess we just said, Jane Souter defeated Mark Souter, a margin of 8,050 votes to Mark Souter's 6,982 votes. So another, it's like strikingly similar numbers, 53.55% to 46.45%. And then in, yes, in District 1 seat B, Cornell Razor receiving 63% of the vote to go back to Boise next term over Chuck Lohman, his challenger, with 36.83%. So a 9,000 vote total for Cornell Razor, 9,314 to be precise. So the other two races much tighter, and Cornell Razor's victory pretty significant. Let's see. Moving on to countywide races, we have. Hold on. Chloe Cochran had the story on that in the Daily Bee. In the county races, the District 2 county commission race was contested. Asia Williams, the incumbent, has lost the nomination, and Jeff Roberts will be the Republican nominee for Bonner County Commissioner District 2. He does not face a challenger in the general election, so Roberts likely to be the next Bonner County Commissioner from District 2. Steve Smith won the county commissioner seat in District 1, running unopposed, but he will in November be facing an independent challenger in Fred Arn of Sagal. In the county clerk's race, Roger Rudd received a supermajority of the votes. 68.35% of the votes went to Roger Rudd. And Spencer Hutchings was his closest challenger, who got 2,396 votes. And then Joanne Guzzi, also on the race or on the ballot, but she had actually dropped out of the race before the election. And she received 1,266 votes. The precinct committee races were also very interesting, but it's a long list of precinct committee races, who won, who lost. Then, and maybe we'll get into the details of that in just a minute. Let's see. More news. I guess before we talk election, should we just
let's rattle off the other news?
Yeah, rattle off the other election. News. The Department of Environmental Quality awarding Sandpoint $40 million in wastewater funding. Well, Jack, thanks for writing the story about this, and I think Zach, you had a piece in the Reader maybe last week or the week before about wastewater treatment. I can't remember. But this is that's a large figure. How is the city administration feeling about this, Jack? You spoke to him in your piece here.
About
wastewater treatment, I guess. About the funding, receiving this this grant. This was long hoped for, I guess.
Mostly a loan, actually.
It's mostly a loan, and I think they're feeling good about that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they're in search of grants, but that's been hard to come by. I think every time this topic comes up, mm-hmm. Jeremy Grimm kind of opines at the dais about how there really isn't a ton of grant funding out there. So anything they can get that's low interest and does come with a little bit of grant funding is good. I think the bigger news for the city, though, is they had a successful meeting with the DEQ director on using an alternative treatment method sometime in the beginning of this month. That's something that the mayor, Jeremy Grimm, has talked about for a long time. Actually, I think dating back to when this topic first of the wastewater plant kind of first came up, and it's to work with the INI problem, the infiltration and inflows that can triple the intake into the plant daily. If they're able to get this kind of flexibility with their permits with DEQ, that would save the city around $10 million when actually building this plant. So I think that's the bigger news, and really what they're focusing on moving forward is getting that permit flexibility so they can build a smaller plant and then moving forward with the actual funding mechanisms for that.
Well, okay. A possible $10 million savings. Well, that's
but you say it's a smaller plant.
It would be a smaller plant, yes.
Does that allow for growth that we're seeing? I mean, how does that figure in?
I mean, they have to build to their permit, and I think it would fit their permit. I'm not sure exactly how the growth would fit in. That's definitely a question that I will ask next time, for sure. Because they seem pretty confident in going after this alternative treatment method. And I think the plant, you know, we're not talking significantly smaller, but there would be cost savings there just because instead of building a plant to manage 10 million gallons, they would just build one for managing the more usual days that they see, around one or two.
And you've got to remember, too, also, I can jump in real quick.
Go ahead.
The city administration's under a lot of political pressure to keep the cost for this down as much as they possibly can and seek outside funding as much as they can, because that was the pitch that was made to the voters when the city went out for that bonding authority on the ballot. And that was the reason it passed so overwhelmingly. It was like 90% of people who voted in favor of giving the city that authority. But that support was entirely predicated on the idea that the plant would be as affordably funded as possible, so that as little of that expense would land on ratepayers as possible. So I think there's a real push at City Hall to get any dollar they can get from any source to throw at this project, and to find any way to make the plant itself more efficient and lower the cost of the actual construction. So I think that, you know, to your question about, you know, how they're feeling, I'm sure they're extremely relieved that they got at least a big chunk accounted for, even if it is a loan that we have to pay back. But at least it's not necessarily going to land on the ratepayers, because if we have to shoulder that burden by any significant percentage, people are going to see their sewer bills go up like dramatically. So,
right.
Expect to see more of them just like pounding the pavement, trying to get money anywhere.
But that loan is that's a significant chunk of the total amount that they're seeking. Moving on to, I guess, other news that was in the papers this week. The school board, Lake Pend'Oreille School District, has kind of announced at their meeting on May 12th that although they are moving the Lake Pend'Oreille High School, that is the kind of the alternative high school that currently is in the building that was once called the Lincoln School building. Its current location is changing, but the school district has announced that they are not planning to sell that building. So the school district will maintain ownership of the building that Lake Pend'Oreille High School is in currently, even as Lake Pend'Oreille High School changes their location to the next year. I believe they're moving there.
No, not next year.
Oh, right.
Year after next.
They're moving
year after next.
They're moving the electives to the high school, I believe, next year. And then the year after that, they'll vacate the building altogether.
They've had electives at the high school for quite some time.
They bus them there for that.
Yeah.
And that's one of the cost savings they're seeking by having the campus right there.
There you are.
They've been consistent to say throughout that they didn't intend to sell that property. So this was kind of a clarification, I think.
Yeah, it's been controversy in town. What's going on with that building and with the Lake Pend'Oreille High School. Mark Furman, passed away. The retired Los Angeles police officer, police detective Mark Furman, notable for his turn on the witness stand during the O.J. Simpson trial in the mid-1990s, moved to North Idaho after that, and he has passed away. But yeah, long time resident of our area, and he spent some time in Sandpoint and then down in Kootenai County.
He moved up here in 1995, actually, and
you spoke to him, didn't you, Chris?
Well, I interviewed him for Sandpoint Magazine in 1997.
Yeah. Yeah,
but he moved up here before the verdict in the O.J. Simpson trial was announced, and we were besieged. The town was besieged by the national media. And we're talking about, he had a house on Euclid Street at that time, and I went down to see what was going on, and there were TV trucks and reporters in the street, and they were all ganged up all around his house, and. When I interviewed him, I asked him, "Well, what were you doing when that was going on outside?" He said, "You know what I was doing? I grabbed something to drink or eat, and I went in my TV room and watched an old Western."
just tuned him out.
Yeah, tuned him out. And Jack, did you ever interview Furman?
I never spoke to him.
No,
you're talking to Zach.
Zach,
did you ever talk to
Furman? I didn't interview him, but I knew him through other people. One of my high school girlfriends babysat his kids for a bit.
Mm.
I wasn't quite in the journalism game at that point yet.
Yeah. Well, he was pretty, he wasn't all warm and cuddly with me when I interviewed him because he's had a pretty rough turn in the media at that time. And I didn't interview him until after he wrote his book, Murder in Brentwood. Which was his side of the story of the whole thing. But, he was painted as the racist cop, and the defense claimed that he had planted a bloody, a bloody glove. And it was a big thing in 1995. The O.J. Simpson trial was completely sensationalized. And Jack, you were around for that.
Right? I was certainly. I remember the O.J. Simpson trial.
And Zach, you probably
I'm old
did.
Enough to remember it. Yes.
But Jack Freeman here reminded me. There's a lot of people that really aren't even clued in on what the whole thing was about because Jack here wasn't even born at that point.
Yeah, it was. Okay. I was in grade school at the time. I remember them actually wheeling in a television into my classroom to watch the. When the verdict was announced, it was the only news story in the world, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, it was everywhere. It was the only thing anyone was.
It was pretty
discussing.
Crazy.
It was a different media environment.
And Mark Furman caught the brunt of that. He really did get painted as the central figure that caused the prosecution to lose. But if you read his book and you talk to him, he had his side of the story. And if you want to check it out, Sandpoint Magazine. We actually put a link up to it on Facebook, on the Sandpoint Online and Sandpoint Magazine Facebook pages, if you want to read that interview with him, which is just right after all that stuff happened. I will say it was amazing. The post we put up on Facebook has been viewed 120,000 times. It went viral. We stuck it up there, the day after we found that it was announced that he had died.
Yeah.
So that's just kind of a measure of the interest that people had about in the whole case.
And still have. Yeah. We're on the, it was so urgent for us to get Zach on the phone that we had to reach him at home even after his surgery because he's kind of our Idaho statewide politics guru here in this area. And I wanted to ask Zach just for a picture of the statewide election results. I could go down the list and just announce the names of the winners and losers of the various Republican primaries, but it wouldn't inform us very much. It wouldn't paint a very colorful picture, I don't think, for the listeners. So, Zach, have you been watching the statewide Republican Party political turnout here on election day? Do you have a any takeaways from kind of what kind of candidates won and lost, and what kind of elected officials we're going to see in Boise next year should these candidates prevail in November?
Certainly. Well, I've had nothing but time to watch this as I'm sitting around with my foot up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that the overall story statewide is that the legislature, you know, should these candidates get through in November to the general, if we have the slate that it looks like we're going to have based on the primaries, we're going to have a slightly more moderate legislature overall, which probably doesn't necessarily track with the results we saw here in Legislative District 1. We were a little bit of an outlier, actually. Statewide, some of the more identifiably right-wing, more conservative legislators lost their primaries. There's a group called the Gang of Eight, which is eight legislators from various parts of the state who all sort of have coalesced together as an informal kind of voting group that is dramatically opposed to any funding increases of any type. They want to slash the budget harder. They're sort of the no government is the best government kind of wing of the party. And of those eight legislators, five lost their primaries, which was really a surprise, I think, to a lot of longtime state politics watchers. You know, people like Glenda Zuderveld in Twin Falls, she's been a very prominent member of that Gang of Eight and really a strong voice for dramatic budget cuts. She lost. I mean, she got 40% of the vote. Which was, you know, a significant loss for her in Twin Falls. And then we had, you know, Lucas Kaler in Nampa. He lost. David Levitt in Twin Falls also lost. Faye Thompson in McCall. Josh Cole in Twin Falls. They all went down in their primaries. And that's going to really kind of color the next session should those results hold through November. Also of note was Jim Guthrie. He's a lawmaker in Eastern Idaho. One of the chair of the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee, you know, the extremely powerful budget setting committee. He gained a lot of prominence in the last session for being sort of the, you know, voice of reason, I guess, on some level, for how to manage the budget issues that we dealt with in the last session and will certainly deal with again in the next session. So he held on to his seat by a pretty good margin as well. And actually, that was the most expensive primary race in the state. Guthrie versus Worley over in Eastern Idaho. Their campaign spent a cumulative $500,000, which, you know, is more than we spent here, but ours was among the more expensive too.
Yeah.
So, you know, Jim Woodward, I think, raised like $122,000, and Scott Herndon raised $104,000. But next to ours, you know, that Guthrie-Worley race was kind of broke the bank. And with Guthrie going back into the legislature, and as, you know, a leader of the Joint Finance Appropriations Committee, and with this Gang of Eight sort of scattered to the wind, we might have a different tone of budget conversation going forward. Obviously, you know, if Jim Woodward had made it through the primary and gone through in November, he also would have retained his seat as co-chair on JFAC. So, you know, without him in the running, it'd be, you know, if Herndon gets through and, you know, takes that seat as well, he might kind of tip the balance a little bit further back toward that sort of Gang of Eight idea. But, you know, time will tell. But you know, overall,
Zach, do you think it's that it's likely that Herndon will get that that chair that Woodward holds?
It seems to hold, you know, that a legislative district one senator serves on that committee. You know, Sean Keogh was on that committee for many, many years. And then Woodward was on it, you know, every time he's been in the state house, and Herndon has served on it. So presumably, yeah. I mean, you never know. I mean, they set the committee assignments, you know, sort of in a secret meeting, and we won't find that out until, you know, after the November election and probably into, you know, sort of December when they'll make those assignments. So who knows? But, I mean, no matter what, you know, lacking this strong Gang of Eight, and then with Jim Guthrie being returned in a pretty resounding primary victory, you know, the conversations around budgeting aren't necessarily going to be the same as they were last time around, with a lot of resistance to, you know, not cutting huge amounts. And there could even be some effort to return some money to some of these programs, because we haven't really felt the full effects of all the cuts yet that they made in that last session. So as Idahoans start to kind of see the realities of what those cuts look like, there could be a change in conversation. and now we'll have a legislature that might be more amenable to listening to those concerns, which, you know, it's interesting turn of events. I don't know that I was expecting that, but, you know, it is what it is. Voters apparently weren't too keen on this Gang of Eight in a lot of their home districts. So that was one of my big kind of aha moments. Yeah, so it surprised me.
But as you mentioned, that's kind of the opposite of what we saw here.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, you know, if you want to take our results out and sort of put a spotlight on them in the context of a statewide voting tally. I mean, our turnout, while still not huge, it was like 45 or something percent.
45%, yeah.
Yeah. But the just the pure number of votes that our candidates got in District 1 are pretty big compared to the rest of the state. I mean, you look at some of these other races around Idaho and, you know, the vote totals for these candidates are like, you know, 1,000-something votes total.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or like 5,000 votes total, but we were in the 8,000, 7,000 range. So the voters in our district were very energized relative to the size of our population. I mean, we have something like 30,000 registered voters in District 1. And to see those big numbers like that, that you know, are even bigger than some of the districts that are much larger in population than we are. So we have a very energized electorate here.
We do. Yeah, statewide, the number I saw for voter turnout was 30%.
Yeah.
So we were considerably above that here, even though still less than half the registered voters managed
right.
to vote.
Well, I mean, even like Jordan Redmond, he ran unopposed. He's one of the more prominent sort of conservative, hard conservative lawmakers. He's been very high profile in the past session or two. You know, he's the one who donated $250,000 of his own money into a special sort of pack that gave money to candidates for, you know, their campaigning materials and stuff, including ours in District 1. So he ran unopposed in Kootenai County. He's a very high-profile legislator. His total votes were 8,365. And that is obviously a much larger population area than we are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he was unopposed, you know, so clearly there's going to be a little bit of a lower number, but still, I mean, the fact that we had, you know, bigger numbers than that in our district mm-hmm. for total votes cast shows you how much more keyed into the election our people were than a lot of others around the state. So, and that may translate into the general because all those positions are contested.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. Yes. That's pointing out in our county or our district, first district, all three of the legislative seats are contested.
Yeah.
In the general.
I think that's definitely something that needs to be sort of reiterated as much as possible, is that we've all kind of bought this idea that the primary is the election, and whoever wins the primary is sort of a foregone conclusion that they're going to win in the general, but that isn't the case. We do have an entire other election. I mean, nobody actually wins anything in a primary except for a party's nomination to run. So none of this is a done deal.
Yeah.
If the voter turnout is high and, you know, people come out for these challengers, you know, in the general, then there's no reason at all why the folks we saw who won the primary will go on to become legislators.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out that Herndon ran against his upcoming opponent in the general election, Steve Johnson, as a write-in.
Right.
And he got over 40% of the vote as a write-in, which is a heck of a feat. So
it was a historic turnout for a write-in candidate. No one had ever seen a write-in candidacy that strong that anyone could remember statewide.
Yes.
And with Johnson's name actually on the ballot in November, you know, it removes that one step that people had to take, you know, which is a pretty high barrier. I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot to, you know, have to write somebody's name on a line, but, you know, the handwriting could be bad. It could go outside the line. You know, any number of things could happen with a write-in to spoil that vote. So, I mean, having him on the ballot makes it a lot easier for people just to fill in the bubble and be done with it. So I think we could expect to see a very robust turnout, you know, for Steve Johnson
yes.
in November.
And which would, of course, affect the other races as well for the seats that Cornell holds. Cornell is going to be facing
Catherine Larson
as an mm-hmm. independent.
Yep.
And then Jane Souter is going to be facing Karen Mathie as a Democrat. So all three of those races are going to be contested, and we can imagine it'll be a feisty one there too.
I think that it will. I think I mean, especially because they are it's going to be head to head. There's not going to be a three way, you know, split of any of these votes. It's going to be, Yeah, they're and all three of their challengers are, if not perfectly politically aligned, at least, you know, they'll be able to draw from the same kind of pool of voters and probably campaign together, or at least kind of muster their efforts together, I would imagine. Even though they're not running on the same party, the party line, but it's going to be an interesting election.
The general election typically gets a bigger turnout than the primary, but up here, the primary is where a lot of these decisions are kind of made de facto. All the county races are unopposed, the Republican nominees there.
Yeah.
That's not right. Fred Arnn is right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
As an independent.
As an independent.
For commissioner.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's always the idea, too, you know, like these other candidates who are running against those who won the primaries, they're not going to have access to the funding that is available to people who, you know, like Herndon Razor and Jane Souter. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you look at the Sunshine reports for the campaign financing, and, you know, Matei, Larson, and Johnson have, you know, like from $0 in their war chest, like Steve Johnson, to like $700 for Catherine Larson. And that's up against, you know, like close to $100,000, you know, that Herndon has in his war chest still. Mm-hmm. Oh, but, still, you know, money isn't everything either. So when you look around the state, like Lori McCann in Lewiston, you know, she outraised Dan Foreman significantly, but he won his race against her. And same with, what was her name? Krista Hazel in Coeur d'Alene. She outraised Elaine Price, and Elaine Price won, and she's part of that gang A. She's one of the three that held on to their seats. So you can't necessarily just say, like, well, they have more money, so they're going to win. You never know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all about who turns out to vote, ultimately.
Yeah, right. I mean, and the way that the way that money is spent is kind of makes you, yes. Well, one wonders what's the most effective use of campaign finances. Jack Freeman, you're the youngest person in the room or on the phone, and this would be your first primary election here in North Idaho. Mm-hmm. You were here for last November's election, but that was municipal. I don't know what attracted your attention, or what interested you as a relatively new political observer to this area. Any major takeaways from this past Tuesday's election?
Yeah, I was definitely it was a surprising outcome, I think, when you look across the rest of the state, just because, you know, I was kind of keeping tabs on a lot of it. And so I think it was definitely a little surprising to me. It's like you said, it's definitely a whole different political world from mm-hmm. where I come from and the things that I've seen in the past. I was kind of surprised about how much it mattered to be a Republican, or whatever that means. That was kind of, you know, the rhino term was something that I was totally unaware of, I guess, that it, you know, mattered so much. And so it was definitely an education covering it and seeing how it works, especially in this primary stage where it is treated as the de facto election in a way. I don't even think many people in California or things like that, like where I'm from, care about the primary elections, but up here it was a really big deal. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely an education, and I was surprised by the result, but I think November will be all the more interesting because of it.
Yeah. I would agree. The rhino, that rhino term, I mentioned this on Wednesday, Chris, I mean, when we were going over the election results, but it is still kind of surprising. I mean, people are fighting over kind of what is a Republican within the Republican Party. There's, especially on the editorial pages, the letters to the editor here in the Reader and in the Bee are full of people just sort of accusing the opponents of not being true, true Republican candidates. And it's kind of it's surprising to me that, looking just at Jim Woodward's background and biography, that a longtime military man, small business owner who returned basically to the same small town that he's from, that people are saying, well, that's not a real Republican. He's, you know, I mean, he's the target. I mean, he's the picture of what you would, you know, of what the National Republican Party at least tries to sell itself as. So it's surprising that people will just say, like, no, he's not it. He's not the genuine article. And it's, I don't know. I think.
Well, I think that's a product of having a closed primary race for the Republicans,
yeah,
for one. And then, I mean, that's a term that I think probably Donald Trump has popularized with his base, too. You know, he has these litmus tests for, you know, who's really with him. Mm-hmm. And in his case, it's like a Trump Republican or a traditional Republican, I guess.
Yeah.
And there's not very many traditional Republicans left, at least on the federal level.
Right. Or
ones that will stick up for being in the face of Trump's wrath.
There was, Idaho wasn't the only state with primaries on Tuesday, and there were some significant.
Tom Massey lost in Kentucky.
Yep.
And, you know, a well-respected guy by all the Republicans, even. And Trump went after him.
Yeah, kind of the last.
That was it for him.
The last and loudest voice within the Republican Party against Trump, at least on a few issues.
Only a few issues.
Yeah, not across the board. Oh, well, we are well over our time. Anything to say about the governor's race? I'll say that I was a little surprised that Governor Little couldn't even crack 60%. He was sure to win that nomination, I think, but I thought it might be a little bit more convincing. But then again, yeah. I guess in a field with eight, maybe that is pretty convincing. What do you think there, Zach?
He gets, Brad Little gets tarred with that rhino thing a fair bit, as well. He takes a lot of fire from the right wing of his party and has ever since COVID. With Representative Heather Scott, just south of us, back in those days, she was calling him Little Hitler.
Because
of the business closures and the public health safety protocols and things. So he lost a lot of good faith from that right wing during the COVID pandemic, but he's worked really hard ever since, sort of the new Trump administration to cozy up to a lot of those ideas. I mean, if you follow Brad Little on Facebook, I mean, it's every day he's got some "I love Donald Trump" kind of post.
And I believe Trump did endorse him, didn't he?
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I think Brad Little has made a concerted effort to bring himself back to the right wing a little bit. To shore up that support, because he does take a lot of flack from the right wing of his party. And you see that with Mike Fitzpatrick, the challenger who did the best out of that crowded field. I mean, he's a fire-breathing right-wing activist, and he did pretty well statewide, relatively speaking. Mm-hmm. That shows you that support's out there for a more right-wing version of the governorship than Brad Little has ever presented.
Of course, we are a heavily Republican state, but it's worth pointing out that he will have an opponent in the general election, too, with Terry Pickens. And actually, there's a Libertarian, Paul Sand, that will be on the ballot as well. And the same is true. David Roth, the Democrat for senator, is going to be going against Jim Risch. And for in the District 1 House race, Kaylee Peterson will be going against Russ Fulcher. So there are races coming up, folks, in the general election.
Well, Todd Achilles, too.
That'll be a name to watch for sure.
Mm-hmm. Todd Achilles is the big everyone's kind of watching him, yes.
Yes, yeah.
Let's see. Let's talk. We got to wrap it up here. I think we're well over our allotted time, but you can, if you're interested in hearing more and you didn't tune in on Wednesday, Chris, you and I did go down every single result of the election, and we also
including the precincts.
We talked a little bit about the precincts,
which we didn't have a chance to talk about here, but there were there's an ideological split there in the Republican Central Committee, I think eight of the more moderate people won seats there.
Yeah, there was a kind of a concerted effort to change the ideological makeup of the of the Central Committee, which is a powerful political entity here, and not a full success, but it is going to be there's going to be a debate at the Central Committee meetings, I think, from now on, most likely, even though the majority kind of holds. Yeah. Jack Freeman, anything you want to mention coming up in the paper, or anything we didn't talk about today? Any final thoughts before we sign off?
Yeah, if you want to go pick up today's Bonner County Daily Bee, I've got all the news from Wednesday's city council meeting, talking Kratom, STR ordinances, and all that fun stuff. So can check that out and see what happened.
Short-term rental is STR.
Oh, yes, yeah. Short-term rental, yes. So there's all the info on that, and much more to come, because it's just starting to pick up budget season, so we're all getting ready for that. That's always fun, right?
Zach, your paper, the Sandpoint Reader, is on newsstands right now. Anything else you want to highlight say?
I'll be perfectly honest with you. I have been out all week. I haven't even seen a copy of the paper, so.
Well, your name is in it and all over it.
Well, I wrote some things in advance. I wrote about the what's going on with the passenger bridge, the Long Bridge.
That's right.
Having a lot of vandalism of the traffic control devices on the pedestrian bridge.
Yeah, and they're actually talking about closing the bridge, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the ITD was trying really hard to keep that span open from end to end so that folks could use it for bicycling or walking or whatever. But if they keep having instances of people taking down those barriers and, you know, the barrels and the tape and everything, it's not going to be safe for people to be on that bridge at all. So they'll block it off. Mm-hmm. So they kind of put that out there.
Is that vandalism with a purpose? I mean, why would people be vandalizing that stuff?
Why do people vandalize things?
there's people that are vandalizing things because they have some, you know, opinion about it shouldn't be.
Some people do it because it's just fun to do, I guess. Yeah. Other people, apparently, according to ITD, what they told me was that they've had at least one or two people tell their crews, like, we're going to keep taking these down for as long as you keep putting them up. So that suggests to me that there's some kind of feeling that you can't tell me what to do on this public property. And how dare you tell me that I can't use a portion of this bridge? That sort of idea.
Yeah. It doesn't really track logically.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, sure. Go fall in the lake, I guess. You know, I mean.
Yeah. Well,
people are strange, I guess, maybe might be the ultimate answer.
There's an interesting thought. People are strange. And we are, I think with on that note, we can
end every broadcast with
the people are strange refrain. Yeah.
That's right. Okay. Well, we're signing off. There's more political, more things to talk about on the political scene, more things to talk about in the news, but we're going to have to leave it there for now. And we'll be back next week with more North Idaho News of the Week. Now, here's a little something from The Doors. Zach, thanks for calling in.
Thank you.
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down, when you're strange.